I'd like to call this talk The Unattainable. Just before lunch, Melissa asked about something we played with in the movement, the connected movement time. The chance to kind of lay bare the mechanism in the mind of separation. How the mind believes in being observed and being judged, and that gives us the excuse to protect and defend and control and censor. And when we realize that we're all in the room with our eyes closed and we're not being watched, and we're not being observed, and the teacher herself has said there's not a right way to do this, whatever you do is good. We can actually start to get that that happens within our own mind, because it seems like it happens in reality, in the interpersonal reality. And I love how Melissa asked the question, like, so, but what else is there? Because so much of our experience is about that separation. And so much of the experience that we have that we can talk about requires that separation and judgment. And so much of our experience that we can't talk about, that we can't get, but it's still in our experience, happens anyway, even however much separation we feel, however alone, however defensive, however right, however wrong we feel. There's still this other life living itself in us. Sometimes it might be a really underground stream that we could barely sense. But one reason it's so hard for us to stick to our spiritual practice is that it's not something that we can hold on to. It's exactly what we can't hold on to. To keep leaving room for what we can't hold on to, but it is real and enriching. So it's real and ungraspable, it's unpredictable, but it is enriching in a real way. So we can notice the enrichment. Even if we can't know in the way that we're used to knowing, so we kind of can't properly know what we're talking about. And as soon as we start to name it something, it starts to go off track. And nowadays, a big challenge for us is that we don't have much confidence. Even if, in many ways, being in a first world country, we have kind of privilege and power that we're hardly aware of. And so we have a certain kind of confidence that we can have a certain kind of lifestyle. We can get certain kinds of things done. But confidence in living or in confidence in life, we don't have much, or we don't have very often. And so we tend to turn towards what we can name and hold on to, what we can remember in our minds instead of what we can remember in other ways. And so I just found out yesterday when we came to look at this room and make sure that they still had it reserved for us, which we had a small moment of surprise when he couldn't figure out if we had the room or not. And I saw on the schedule that this is called a day of mindfulness, these Saturday and Sunday, days of mindfulness. Oh, is that what we're going to do? Okay. And I love in the lineage of the word mindfulness, if we can kind of fill it out again. So Gautam Buddha reinterpreted this long time tradition of using the word remembrance, smriti, as one important aspect of life. I don't really like to call it spiritual life, but like life. It's important to remember. It was usually meant to mean remembering important teachings or remembering what's important. And then at the time that Gautam Buddha was alive, it was important for him to call upon another kind of remembering. More like remembering coming back together, bringing the pieces back together. And knowing life as it's happening. Just knowing the life of the mind, the life of the heart, the life of the body, the life of the being as it comes up. And he gives a great image. He had really great images, great metaphors. He was definitely a genius. And one of his images for what he called remembrance, so it went from the Sanskrit smriti to the Pali sati, remembrance. The image was a big barrel full of water, and if one drop of water would come into that barrel, another drop would have to go out because it was completely full. Sometimes the word mindfulness in English is kind of a joke because we come with our minds so full of crap, basically, of thoughts that we've thought many times that aren't true, that hurt us and hurt other people. And maybe, or probably, there's another kind of fullness that we've also experienced. And the practice of mindfulness as it's taught nowadays is one way into that fullness. So the way people talk about mindfulness today is that noticing what are the contents of my experience now as it happens. Noticing that's a thought, that's an emotion, that's a mood that's entering my bloodstream and taking over. We can notice it. That's a pain, that's an opening, that's a pleasure, that's a contraction. That's heat, that's cold, etc. By letting any one experience for any one second or split second be fully itself. So this image of the barrel can have many layers or applications. Letting any one moment be fully itself. So just the sensation of an out-breath, each sensation of the out-breath. Letting it just be itself and letting that be fully itself, so we are somehow allowed to echo that fullness, because we're not trying to gauge the out-breath, was it a good out-breath or not. We're just experiencing it. So letting the experience be lets us be, and that allows the fullness of the experience to resonate with the fullness of one's own being. What I wish for, it's an important factor to take care of when we practice mindfulness. Usually what I find is the practice of mindfulness starts to lean towards the practice of policing. policing yourself and others. So it stops really being mindfulness, and it starts being having some ideas and then enforcing them. So that includes projection, as you were questioning, was that my experience, was that projection? Okay, that was my experience. But how easily it could start to then also go to projection and become a fixed idea about, I always like my food better on the in-breath or whatever, instead of now, yeah, it's more alive. Or it could be the idea that everyone should experience it that way or whatever. This is what we see happening. And so again, we have that not wholeness, where I'm not just letting the experience be, but I'm expecting what it should be and watching whether it is or isn't, trying to match it, gauge it. And it isn't, almost always it isn't. Our experience is almost never what we think it should be. And when it does match what we expect, for that it just happens to match what we expect randomly for such a short time, the kind of elation that we feel is so empty, so unfulfilling. So much of an invitation to suffer as soon as it falls apart. So there's a true story about a police officer in the country of my birth. And he liked to think of himself as a peace officer. And this is what I hope mindfulness practice could lead us towards. Instead of letting that obvious tendency take over too often, it's going to happen in observing, controlling, expectation, anticipation, hating, looking forward to, etc. So more suffering instead of freedom. So this guy worked in an area of town that was not an easy area, so some people who are police officers have easier jobs than others. So this guy had a not so easy beat that he did. And he actually loved it because he would practice feeling and intuiting where he needed to be to prevent something going wrong, so violence, aggression, etc. And he would do it. He would follow through on what came to him, and he would go there. And you can imagine how often just the appearance of someone in a uniform would prevent someone from doing something they would later regret. Not to mention how the others would also regret that the person was violent or whatever. And so could it be possible without a uniform inside us to feel the authority, not to enforce a law, so not to have that kind of power where the law has been agreed on and I have been chosen to enforce it. A different kind of authority. An authority that lets something come through and I, to the best of my ability, follow that direction to show up where I need to notice what needs to be noticed, so that I don't do what I would regret and that others will regret my doing. You may have noticed today and on other days that something catches your eye or you happen to hear something that you might even think, oh, I wasn't supposed to hear that. Or why am I noticing that person's tear? Like they probably want to be alone. They want their space or whatever. And just letting the day unfold, you find out that it's not that there was a reason that you saw that or heard that or whatever, but that it can be for the benefit of all. That came into your noticing. It might be something really practical, like you have a tissue. Or that some small interaction ends up leading to a deep friendship with that person that's good for both of you. In this peace officership, the practical and the less practical are completely interwoven. So sometimes we might want to be on a more sublime mission, like we're willing to follow our intuition if something really amazing is going to happen and all they want is a tissue. Or we might be like ready to serve as long as they just need a tissue, nothing else. And what happens is more mysterious and enriching. And more beyond what we would choose. What we would say now, yes, okay. It's beyond what you would say yes to. It's beyond what you think you are. And that's one of the great things about it. So a small situation can evolve, if you agree to participate, into something that calls on you in ways you didn't, you were like, I didn't sign up for this. Including the having to say no part. It's not that it just means someone, just because you gave them a tissue, can take over your life and move in. Sometimes the saying no part is the part that you didn't sign up for. But life wants to, as if life wants to, something in you that's really alive wants to be stretched beyond what you think you can. And there's something in us that's stronger than we are in a way that we are not, we as we know ourselves. So I'd like to read a poem by Mary Oliver. It's actually more like a little prose paragraph. I think it was in a poetry book though. It's called The Bleeding Heart. Do you have those here? It's a plant. They're really cool. Yeah? They make these really cool flowers that look like hearts. I know a bleeding heart plant that has thrived for 60 years, if not more, and has never missed a spring without rising and spreading, itself into a glossy bush with many small red hearts dangling. Don't you think that deserves a little thought? The woman who planted it has been gone for a long time. And everyone who saw it in that time has also died or moved away. And so, like so many stories, this one can't get finished properly. Most things that are important, have you noticed, lack a certain neatness. More delicious, anyway, is to remember my grandmother's pleasure when the dissolve of winter was over and the green knobs appeared and began to rise and to create their many hearts. One would say she was a simple woman, made happy by simple things. I think this was true. And more than once in my long life, I have wished to be her. So what Oliver is calling simple is what Gautama was calling full. There's something in us that rises like the plants each spring, and even when it seems that it had been dead for so long, it wasn't. And it comes back as a surprise to us. And the strange thing is that this happens again and again. I mean, in our inner lives now. I think now we kind of get that spring comes. Just maybe before it all starts to fall apart, who knows. But we kind of get that spring comes. And plants usually come back. But it happens in us also, again and again, that we think that something has died in us and it comes up. Without missing a spring. It's a kind of strength that we didn't know we had. It's a kind of strength that we can't do on purpose. We can't sort of call on it when it's wintertime. But we can call on wintertime when it's wintertime. We can feel how that strength that is able to wait and to rise and to spread out and be glossy. Has something to teach us. And the first thing it could teach us, the most like basic instruction that we could, I need to change my basic instructions. The basic instruction is don't believe what you think about your own experience. Don't believe the interpretation that's going on. If you think you're doing well, if you think you're doing wrong, don't believe it. Sometimes we need encouragement so that we can keep going along with what we need to go along with. It's good if we water the plant sometimes. Even if the plant can come back by itself, it's good if we water it sometimes. Sometimes we need to encourage each other, remind each other, so that we can enjoy the fullness of the moment of watering and not let it always be something to check off of our list. The curious thing is, a lot of times we torture ourselves about how wrong we think we are, how bad, what a bad meditator, how busy the mind, etc. And then there kind of has to be at least a little bit of time to compensate for that where we think we're doing great. But we hardly really notice that even because it's just compensation. It's just part of that wheel. And the interesting thing is that despite that torture, there is still this underground life going that will come back up. And so if we could kind of get that that's unnecessary torture, could help unravel something that's important to unravel. The unraveling is letting it all be so much that we don't buy into this idea that there is a right way to be that we've got to be, or make excuses for why we're not. And who would want to live that way? We don't, and so we don't. We don't want to live that way, and so we don't. We hold back from our lives. And still there's something more persistent than us. However doggedly we allow that judgment mind to take over, however dogged that habit is, there's something that is more sweetly persistent. Harder to notice. It has a much lighter touch. It's harder to weigh it as important because it's not heavy-handed. But even this little bit that we've been aware of in our lives so far has been enough. Without missing a spring, something that seems to be gone but is reliable, but doesn't do our bidding. That can last beyond death. In the poem, she says, the woman who planted it has been gone for a long time, and everyone who saw it in that time has also died or moved away. She's kind of whispering about something in us that's so subtle that it can't die. That's so subtle that it was before we are, before we were. And it's that simplicity that's enriching. And so full that it stretches us and we shy back. If we could start to know the bargain that we're making and what a bad deal it is, if we could start to really feel it in our bones. It's not to blame ourselves that the judging mind takes over. It's a strong habit, and we have tons of training to keep it up and to not let it go for anything. Like to cling to it as you die is sort of our motto these days. So it's not surprising that we don't notice our own life passing, going on, coming up every spring, lasting before our birth and beyond death, and never bothering quite to finish. Most things that are important, have you noticed, lack a certain neatness. Can't quite get finished properly. So our wish for things to be ended, to get to the end, so that then we could be at peace, is part of this sort of machine of suffering that we keep sitting in and turning on and driving around. And it's scary to get out of that thing, to turn it off, even if you stay in the seat and just turn it off. Is scary to get out of it, is scary, that lightness. So sometimes if we could just tune into how it's not just a lightness, but in the persistence, in the way that things do come back. Even after the atomic bombs on Hiroshima, the very next spring, the cherry trees flowered. It's much more powerful than any machine. And it's in us. If we can make friends with it, we'll be less afraid of that lightness. We'll start to enjoy. It's almost like being able to fly instead of driving around in a tank. It's a lot like that. Driving around in the tank, of course we want it to end. Of course we don't want to live that way. But to find confidence by tuning into how life is happening around us also. So it's not really my courage that makes me like grit my teeth and get out of the tank of right and wrong and comparing. Envy and competitiveness. But sometimes through being hopeless enough, so that means completely hopeless, or feeling at ease enough, or kind of absorbed in joy enough, that we just accidentally get out of the vehicle. It's almost never when I say, I've got to get out of this thing, I've got to get out of this thing, that we actually get out. Because usually we'll get out and we'll get into the next thing. To actually get out is pretty much when we're not looking. When we're not looking. Or when we start to develop this trust of that persistence and how natural it is and how that means it is in us. Something more persistent, stronger than we are, and smarter, thank goodness. So it keeps coming back, not because it's stupid. An aliveness that is richer and fuller than any version of any story we could tell about it. So as it's happening, we'll have some story going about what we're doing and how our life is unfolding. And what's really happening is more subtle and sweet than even the best story. So we might need a story to kind of keep ourselves on track sometimes when the old habits are really pulling strong. That's fine. But leaving room for what's really going on that's much more full than any story. Anything we could say about what's happening. By leaving more and more room for our lives, there starts to be more and more room for pleasure, which may be a surprise. We usually think of ourselves as kind of using a spiritual practice to steel ourselves against the coming difficulties. Like we'll do this really boring weekend so that we'll be better people later. And what can happen is noticing that we're actually enveloped. Inside, we're filled, and all around, we're enveloped in something pleasurable. It's very hard to notice. But as we start to get practice noticing it and get less and less afraid of it, so more and more trusting that it's not something you're creating or imagining, and it's also not something that's really going to go away. It's a different kind of pleasure. And that's why it's scary. I know you don't believe me. But I also know you've experienced it. So to give you some encouragement, my currently favorite story of Gautam Buddha's life. And I especially choose him because he's like the poster man for suffering, life is suffering. Which was just his realization because he grew up in a situation where his family tried to keep him from having or seeing anyone suffer. And so when he went out into the world and saw that people do suffer, it came as a shock. Most of us have had more the opposite experience. There's been suffering, and we can be shocked to notice that it's not always suffering. So he was shocked and kind of intrigued by this suffering thing that he hadn't experienced until he was a young adult. And so he took on these different practices that were in fashion at the time, which was also about more suffering, where you would cause yourself pain and see if you could take it. You would hold your breath until it hurt. It's kind of a bit of a warped practice that came from someone's true experience of when the breathing wasn't happening and the life was still going on, something that's more persistent than the biology. Just the gap between out-breath and in-breath. And then trying to use that as a way in, letting that gap get longer and longer. With gentleness, that could be really helpful, but just to do yourself harm, kind of, and see how long you can take it. Gautam found it hadn't helped him. And so this is this moment of recognition where we can notice what hasn't helped us. We were trying to do something to help ourselves, and then we could let ourselves know it's not helping. It's hurting. And it's not, as his point was, it's not giving me any superhuman experience. That was his language. And he managed without going to complete hopelessness in this case, but that might be because he had such an easy childhood, he had a lot of confidence. He didn't need to go to complete hopelessness and despair like many of us do. He thought, maybe there's another way. And then a memory came of himself as a child, feeling happy for no reason, feeling at ease and feeling a pleasure in the body and the mind for no reason. Not because he was playing his favorite game or whatever. Just feeling happy for no reason. That's the memory that came to him, as if in response to his thought, maybe there's another way. And he considered that as a possibility. Could that be the way? Could that be a way? Could that be the way for me? So this memory came as if out of nowhere to him in that moment. And he thought, maybe this is the way. And he was scared. He noticed that he was afraid. It was so pleasurable, he was afraid. And then he kind of checked, no, this is a different kind of pleasure. This is not just that wheel of suffering where I feel, okay, now I'm really getting it right, so I can relax and be happy and show off. And then we crash. It's a different kind, a kind of more natural, a natural place of repose where joy comes up and fills us. And so somehow, despite the fear, he managed to like enter on that path and give himself, that means, give himself as much time as possible in that pleasure, immersed in that pleasure, and then let it evolve from there with its own intelligence. Let it keep coming out of nowhere, how the path unfolds. Are there any questions so far? So I have a strange quotation by an unlikely person, Adam Smith, a few years before he wrote The Theory of that has become Capitalism. He wrote a pretty different thing called The Theory of Moral Sentiment. And it's an interesting description of how we often approach meditation and why then the meditation doesn't really work. So Adam Smith here is talking about literal wealth and literal poverty. And I'm talking about inner wealth and inner poverty. And unfortunately, at his time, the custom was to use the masculine as the generic. So he talks about the poor man's son. So I could try. So someone from a poor family, whom heaven in its anger has visited with ambition, admires the condition of the rich. So already in this sentence, there are a few kind of key words or places in the landscape of the sentence that are important to consider in our approach to meditation. Someone from a poor family, so a child in a poor family, the sense of poverty, the sense of lack, the sense of coming from as if it's in my blood, poverty, not enoughness, not rightness. Whom heaven in its anger has visited with ambition. Admires the condition of the rich. So here we are, human beings, and we're each different. But we're enough the same that we could easily see each other's richness and compare ourselves and think that we lack. And think that we are even intrinsically lacking in comparison to you. And if there's not that confidence in life as it is, in all its glossy, spreading diversity, then there can be a kind of fire to get to be like you. What I'm maybe seeing in you or maybe projecting on you. So the condition of the rich appears in our fancy like the life of some superior rank of beings. So we take different as better, superior, and we get, this is where we get swallowed into a kind of machine or mechanism that is nearly unstoppable. Not quite as unstoppable as that more subtle strength, but once we get sucked in, comparing, believing I'm less or more, and you're less or more. Believing that that is a valid framework, an important way of looking at life. Instead of just a sickness and a suffering that we have inherited and that we can be cured of, if we would just face it as painful. If we would just face it as painful, to think lack, to feel lack, to think or project better, superior, the other way is the same. So we, in our fancy, in our imagination, it seems almost like a different kind of being. And in order to arrive at it, so then we make our plan of how to get there, which is a kind of false confidence. Sometimes it's important to see that someone is peaceful in a stressful situation and to realize that's a possibility. And we could feel it resonate in ourselves and let it kind of take root in ourselves and come from within out. But when we try to copy calm in a stressful situation, we're damaging our nervous system. Just repressing all of that wrangling energy. In some moments, that might be the best thing we can do, fine. But we'll need to kind of do something about it after. When we're out of the stressful situation, we'll need to redress or address that repression that we might have used as a temporary measure. So we devote ourselves forever to the pursuit of wealth and greatness, and through the whole of our life, we pursue the idea of a certain artificial and elegant repose, which we may never arrive at. So again, what he's pointing out to us in looking at the more outer life, we're often willing to spend our entire life pursuing an idea. And we're often not willing to spend our entire life allowing something that's not an idea to take root and take over. But we could. We could allow that more subtle, more smart, more sweet, more pleasurable, more alive force that's not forceful take root and take over. We could. Instead of pursuing this idea of a certain artificial repose, which we may never arrive at, and for which we sacrifice any real tranquility that is at all times in our power. And which this artificial and elegant repose, if in the extremity of old age we should at last attain it, we will find it to be in no respect preferable to that humble security and contentment which we've abandoned for it. So it's not a good deal. If we could just face these conflicting forces in us, where there's one that feels insecure, because we are insecure, we are vulnerable, and so something feels insecure and wants to do something about it. And something else feels at ease anyway, even though there is danger. Something else feels at ease anyway. We don't have to even really resolve this conflict, letting it be. So the conflict between our wish that there would just be a right way and we could just obey it, and it would be that kind of simple, and we wouldn't have to be really alive, where we do really get hurt. And another kind of simplicity where there is already, from the beginning and all along the way, fulfillment. And then another fulfillment coming out of this one. Most things that are important, have you noticed, lack a certain neatness. More delicious anyway is to remember my grandmother's pleasure when the dissolve of winter was over and the green knobs appeared and began to rise. Just feeling for yourself, what's more delicious anyway? And let that be wished for. You don't have to kind of make an artificial wishing. One would say she was a simple woman, made happy by simple things. I think this was true. And more than once in my long life, I have wished to be her. Thank you for listening. We have time for walking again and again, fresh air and the kind of challenge of being outside if you feel like it, or being inside if you feel like it.